What's the best thing to say to a racist? I asked you this question earlier on, and I'll ask you again. Racist has gone on about the superiority of white people. And you say, oh, it's a load of baloney, because you bring up a few quotes from people you've been talking about tonight and say, look, there's no evidence to back this up. Well, you can give counter quotations from people, you know, who've got a bit of a reputation themselves. He says, oh, but they say this, they say that. And so I'm sticking my guns, you know. How can you, what else can you say to persuade these people?
Well, I think personally that there are two ways of approaching that. Is it alright if I sit down, do you think, to answer this? I think there are basically two ways of answering that. Two levels. On the one hand, there's the... you could start, you know, you say that this racist gives you some other quotes from other reputable scientists to show the opposite. But let's say that's happened. There are two courses of action you can take. You could well do both. First course of action, argue it out between the quotes, if you like. In other words, look at what these people are saying, and analyse the situation and see whether there's any loopholes in what they're saying, as I'm sure there would be. Because I wasn't, I didn't in fact quote many people during that talk who I would endorse. I was quoting people I was disagreeing with. When it came to putting the arguments against them, I was actually formulating the arguments generally myself. But if I did quote anybody like Stephen Rose, who I agree with most of what he says, I'm not saying you should simply quote that and say, oh, well, you know, Stephen Rose said it, and then therefore it must be right, and that's dealt with the racist. Of course, it doesn't work that way. What I was saying is if you look at what Stephen Rose has written, get hold of some of his stuff, then the arguments themselves will be useful, not because of who said it, but because of what he's saying. So the first course of action is simply argue it out. Whatever quotes are thrown at you, look at them, analyse them, and argue out. I'd say there's a second course of action, which is not to bother with all these quotes at all, and to actually say to a racist, what I would be tempted to say to a racist, to be honest with you, is that, you know, if they want to say, oh, well, whites are intrinsically superior, then I'm going to sort of ask some more good questions, like, which whites? Which people in particular, by name? And superior at what? At doing what? And this sort of thing. And where's the proof of it? And, you know... I mean, I can't rehearse an argument here and now with a racist who isn't present, but you see what I mean? In other words, if you ask, you don't have to start quoting learned authorities, even though I did get a bit entangled in some of the scientific jargon myself this evening. But generally, it's adequate to simply ask all good questions about how it can possibly be proved that all blacks are inferior to all whites, I mean, or the other way around for that matter. It's absurd, because when you're talking about people being inferior, you've got to say, at what? You know, doing a given thing, and you know, and even then you can't really generalise, because you're talking about millions of people. You're dividing the human race into two or three groups, and you're sort of making an outlandish claim which you simply can't prove. The onus is on them to prove it, not us. If a racist wants to claim such an absurd thing, let them prove it to us. But it's a very, very hard thing to prove, for the obvious reason that it's false. But as I said, I think a lot of this you're dealing with, they practically know that they can't win the argument on a logical level. You know, and that's why a lot of it is often backed up by violence, because it's not a very highly rationalised argument. It's very often simply frustration, writ large.
And what if they say about inventions? Most of them seem to come from white people.
Ah, well, on that point, you can win hands down. I mean, you only have to... I'm not very knowledgeable on this sort of thing, but the fragments of knowledge I've got even are sufficient to knock it down. I mean, the wheel, for example, was invented in China. The wheel's surely one of the most universally useful inventions ever. That came out of China, and I'm sure somebody who knows a bit more about the history of science than I do could probably come up with all kinds of examples of how useful inventions have by no means just come from so-called white people or from Britain or Europe or what have you.
Carry.
Oh yeah, you said it.
Did Jim want to say something? Harry?
Yes,
Jim. Racism and nationalism are usually put together.
Yeah.
I thought behind the racial was some kind of a nationalism, you know, which is in itself assuming that a kind of superiority.
I found that as well. It doesn't have to be the case. Somebody could you know, well, it's a bit, I suppose if somebody's a nationalist, they're almost certain to some extent to accept a kind of racism, because they're saying that the people within a national boundary are somehow more important or superior. So I suppose a nationalist is almost inevitably a racist. I don't suppose it's true the other way around, because somebody could be a racist in the sense that they say that, I don't know, all white people, let's say, are superior or what have you. That doesn't mean they necessarily identify with a given nation. But I think generally you're right, the two very much go hand in hand. And in fact, racism can be understood in a way as simply an extension of nationalism. You know, for a racist, it's not enough simply to wave the British flag and say, I defend the British bosses. He has to go further and say that the British bosses and their slavish workers are biologically special as well. So you're quite right, the two almost always go hand in hand.
Aaron.
Yes, Comrade Chairman. I think it's rather unfortunate that we have got to look at this question of biological inequality and all the rest of it from the premise of the so-called experts, because generally speaking, the biological evolutionists and anthropologists don't take their arguments to their logical conclusion. You see, in order to be able to argue this question, one has to make a separation between human nature and human behaviour. Of course, it's something which the evolutionists don't do. Now, the fact of the matter is that as socialists, we have to look at history and prehistory as one process. And in fact, Hegel, Marx, and in particular Engels, did for biological evolutionary theory in the field of philosophy what the anthropologists and biological evolutionists have failed to do. As a matter of fact, they're only just getting round to considering this. Now, the fact of the matter is, of course, that what you have to bear in mind is that when you're talking about history, and when you're talking about prehistory, you've got to use the dialectical method. And the dialectical method, when applied that way, means this, that human beings are the result of natural selection by biological processes, and all animals prior to Homo sapiens, their behavior is largely instinctive. It's built in to a particular species. Now, in relation to human beings, when you're talking about the genotype and the phenotype, the genotype, first of all, of course, you've got to recognize this, that human nature is a concept which applies to a particular species. And all members of that species have the same human nature, except that there are variations in genetic inheritance, which is the phenotype. But the phenotypic variations are so vast in number that they exceed the sum total of atoms in the universe. The possible combinations are so astronomically tremendous. And what it means is, of course, that the variations between human beings with one common nature are very, very slight. And as human beings are the cooperative animal par excellence, it adds up actually to a contribution on a species scale, not on an individual scale. Now, this is what I disagree with with a lot of people that are trying to argue the case against social Darwinism. You see, if you look at the thing and say, all right, well, all of the attributes that we recognise, upright stance, manipulative hands, stereoscopic colour vision, a large brain, these are all characteristics that every human being has got by and large. And that is human nature, which has got very little to do, or at least it has got something to do with human behaviour. But of course, human behaviour is not conditioned like animal behaviour. Human behaviour is not a behaviour which can merely adapt to environmental changes, but it's a potentiality which enables behaviour to operate on the basis of changing the environment. That's a complete difference between the lower animals and the lower primates and man. So that, you see, this argument that they're always talking about, you know, human nature, there's something in human nature which prevents certain kinds of behavior, is a lot of absolute nonsense. Human beings with that kind of potentiality is capable of any behavior. And behavior, of course, cannot be inherited genetically. What is inherited genetically are certain potentialities peculiar to a particular species. Obviously, the inheritance, the genetic inheritance of a human species is far different than the inheritance, genetic inheritance of a horse or of any other animal, or of even a chimpanzee, which is the nearest to human beings. Consequently, you see, what we're doing really is trying to argue from an erroneous ground which has been thought up, it's something which has been sort of foisted upon the so-called ordinary human beings by the specialists in biology, practically all of whom don't really understand their own science. You can only start understanding their own science when they approach the thing dialectically, which they don't. And when socialists approach this argument, they should do it dialectically. Now, the dialectical aspect is this, that the whole of phenomena, as far as Engels was concerned, and as a matter of fact, as far as Marx was concerned, but Engels was the person really that did the hard work on it in the final analysis. But the whole of evolution is a process is a dialectical process. And the dialectical process of biological evolution by natural selection reached a quantitative degree which change the whole aspect into a quantitative one. So that instead of having evolution by natural selection, you now have evolution historically. History is a part of the whole process. But when social aspects come into it, when you have history as distinct from biological evolution, what you have is an animal, the result, the end product of natural selection, which is an animal that can impinge itself upon the environment and change the environment, and it can only do that cooperatively. You see, the enormous range of human behavior intellectually is such that everybody can't know everything, obviously. I mean, the capabilities and the potentialities are so enormous that it's necessary, in order for human society to function, for all of those variations to be used and exercised in a cooperative manner. And of course, the argument that the trouble is that human behaviour and human nature is mixed up together in a very, very sloppy way with these people that use these arguments. And in fact, the only way that you can combat them, in my view, is to make that a particular separation.
I'd just like to comment on the points that were made by the speaker. One of them was that social biology is an point taken about a baby. One of the analogies which I've always been interested in is that a baby sort of born like a blank sheet of paper to be written on, as he progresses or she throughout society. I think one point which was neglected to mention, which is extremely important, which all human beings and everyone, a cichlid form, an amoeba, a parasite, up to the most advanced of Homo sapiens, is that of the need for survival, which overlaps into everything, into social and political reasons and everything like that. What I'm going to go on to is sort of look at a couple of writers who sort of commented on that and looked at society and so forth, and particularly I think two which is of interest is that of Hobbes and Rossi, who looked at society, and both of them came up with two totally divergent points of view. Hobbes believed that prehistoric man was needed this strong discipline, because without a sort of state of a state which enforces people to do something, men just ran about and did what they liked. Whereas Rossi thought that men's actual nature was that of kindness, goodness, and that the society we lived in was, everyone was lovely to each other. I think with both those arguments, the main point to bring out is that they can't be proven, because there was no writing material at the time, and both of them are just what the reader who reads it just says, reads it and feels the one that suits him the best is the one that he wants to see society as. Bring that point a bit further, I think an interesting book was William Golding's Lord of the Flies, who showed how a society would develop without any kind of rules or regulations, and basically made out that people actually started to beat each other up, or however you want to look at it. Again, another book, which was 1984 by George Orwell, showed how people responded when it came to the actual point of taking, I think it was Room 101, when they were in a position where there is always something in life where people would sell out anyone, no matter what. There is something in their mind, something there, that if it came to the most basic thing, love or whatever, would not exist in society. People would want to do what they thought was right. And another thing which I really want to look at is that there's a thing about the population today, which is 4.7 billion, and I think research was done into it and showed that the whole of the Earth's resources could feed people up to something like 33 billion and even more scientific improvements that progress. What I want to ask is, imagine that instead of 33 billion, it was 6 billion. Now, I'm saying that, it obviously is, could be a lot more, but just imagine that it was 6 billion. What would happen then in a socialist society? Because in all societies, you need cooperation. What would happen if there was only the population outnumbered the amount of food? Now, would there be no cooperation? People doing what they, their own share? Because bringing back to the original point which I made, the need for survival, and if that does not exist in a society would just crumble and just turn on everyone.
Well, I'll just got down what you said there. I want to make a couple of quick points on it, or fairly quick hopefully, and then maybe others will want to contribute to the discussion on it. But yes, the baby's mind is a blank sheet, but perhaps even more blank than you suggested, because I would dispute your contention that built into this baby is some kind of desire for survival, either as an individual baby or on behalf of a society. But I argue that even that has to be to a large extent taught to the baby. So that, for example, if you left a baby with food, unless if that food was the slightest bit inaccessible, then it's quite clear that death would intervene. Let me put it another way, the skills for survival, and therefore to a large extent the whole process of trying to survive, has to be taught to such a high degree, even to each baby in turn, that it's certainly dubious. It's certainly dubious indeed to say that this sort of business of survival is somehow really imprinted on the baby at birth. I'm treading warily, as you'll see, because I think anyone would be foolish to pronounce very arrogantly or dogmatically on that point, because I think it's a highly complex point anyway. But that, I wouldn't assume that this sort of desire for survival is sort of there. I think that even that may be largely a matter of something being taught. On Hobbes and Rossi, I must say I don't know Rossi at all, but I get the general point. On the one hand you have Hobbes with his famous statement that life is short, nasty and brutish, or the other way around, or whatever. And presumably Rossi said the opposite, or it could be the opposite. Am I pronouncing the name wrongly or something?
Rousseau.
Oh, well, in that case, I do know Rousseau. No, it's just that I'm sure if we looked, there is in fact also a political philosopher called Rossi, spelled R-O-S-S-I.
Yeah, was a French.
The famous Italian political philosopher. No, seriously, that's why I assumed you meant a different Rossi who I didn't know. If you mean Rousseau, then forgive me. I am aware of what was the point. That's right, a social contract. And so Rousseau says that potentially human nature can be basically cooperative and so on. Although even Rousseau didn't quite go as far, I think, as you suggested. I mean, even Rousseau felt that it was necessary to draw up a social contract in order to make sure that this goes according to plan. But I suppose broadly it's fair to say there are different views. And as you say, these aren't particularly the kind of arguments that can be proven very simply or scientifically. But the thing to bear in mind, I would suggest, is that human nature is neither very cooperative nor very uncooperative. This is the point. Human behaviour can take these two extreme forms, but human nature, as was said in a previous contribution at the front, is almost without limit adaptable in broad terms, very, very flexible. And that's the sort of key point to emerge out of this. And that's what I'd say on Hobbes and Rousseau. On Lord of the Flies in 1984, I very much agree with your suggestion. Whereas they're both, in my view, very good books, and I've immensely enjoyed reading both of them, nevertheless I have a great contempt in a funny kind of way for both books. I think that both books you mentioned, in their own ways, have possibly a deeply cynical conclusion. And in that sense, I think you've touched on an interesting point. But again, it's not quite that simple, because in both cases, the books are not simply saying, this is what must be. And both authors were fairly clear on that outside of those books when questioned on the point. They're not saying, you know, that this is inevitable and this is what's going to happen and so on. They're looking at very specific situations, what might be, what is in danger of being, what could be, and so on. Bear in mind, Lord of the Flies, you say, without rules and regulations, it degenerates into anarchy, and not just anarchy in any kind of good sense, in terms of absence of the state, but chaos, in fact, and violence. But of course, it does in the book. But don't, again, jump to conclusions. I mean, I would say that the reason for that, and in this sense it's a good realistic book, is that you've got a bunch of schoolboys highly conditioned in the ways of competition and so on. And then you suddenly take away all of the limitations and regulations of capitalism and stick them on a desert island. And, of course, they're bringing with them all kinds of conditioning and background, and that's the danger to beware of. Of course, in a social society, the whole argument about socialism is that the precondition has to be satisfied first, of throwing overboard that whole conditioning. So that makes it a somewhat different matter. Then 1984, it's true, they've got the torture chamber, room 101, under the threat of which, even without even actually going through with the punishment, under the threat of which people will forsake their closest friend or lover and so on, because ultimately there's this satisfaction of self-interest. Basically, I would agree with you. Yes, there is ultimately a very strong tendency for people at certain times to satisfy self-interest. And in a sense, that's one of the reasons that we regard socialism as a highly practical possibility, because in that sense, socialism is the ultimate way of satisfying your own self-interest by taking over the world. But I come back to a point there I made earlier on about the harmonisation between individual interests and social interests, between the needs of you, yourself, as a person, and those of the society around you. Basically, capitalism makes those two things opposites, and socialism makes them virtually identical. That, if you like, is a different way of defining the two systems from the more customary way of defining them. And the sense in which socialism is a unity between social and individual interests is that in a socialist society, you're no longer an atom in competition with other property owners or non-owners, in case more often is, but or you're not in competition over jobs or housing or whatever. Because of the absence of competition, if you help to increase social productivity, it's not just going to go to your boss's dividend. In other words, the gain in productivity or usefulness or inventions, all of these things are pooled for the benefit of all. In that sense, anything you can do will help yourself as it helps others simultaneously. Now, in that situation, Room 101, the torture chamber in 1984, clearly loses its significance as a dramatic device. The reason, the whole point of that in the book is to show you that in a society where your own interest is opposed to the interests of the state and so on, then you get these terrible cases of betrayal which people are forced into. But if these interests could be harmonised, so there is no division between, on the one hand, the people, and on the other hand, the state, if there is no state, if the people are administering themselves without an alienated power known as the state, then Room 101 loses its point. Finally, I'm going on a bit, but there were 6 points, and sixth and finally, I'll say, I hope people will come in on these. You say if there were only 6 billion people who could be, if it were only 6 billion who could be fed instead of 33 billion, how would a socialist society talk about coping with a situation if we had enough food for just about the right number or whatever, or perhaps even less than that? And your point is not, I take it very seriously, because although at the moment productive potential seems to indicate that we could feed the world over and over in a socialist society in the long term, that's the hints we're getting from the fragments of information we get our hands on. But it's still a very sensible question, because who knows, through natural disaster, you know, which we can't predict, there may well be a situation where we've got a genuine real shortage within a socialist society. Of a kind that obviously wouldn't have been created socially through the market system and profit and loss, but simply through an earthquake and so on. The answer is through cooperation and through sacrifice. Now, it sounds a bit moralistic, but it's a simple fact. The whole point about a socialist society is that people have a consciousness about serving their interests in a sensible way. A sensible way being defined here is the fact that your interests can only be satisfied by serving the interests of others and vice versa. You've got to have that basic harmony, which only comes in material terms when the means of production are commonly owned. Then you've got your material basis for such a preferable situation.
I just want to say about the question of comrade Bagley, you know, how to answer the patient's demand. But basically, you know, to answer them now, to make argument in a way, sort of you generate now that. You generate now the right. But how? From the start, I talk about the origin. Now, the origin of Marca is Africa. You know, historically, you know, it's proven, you know, once upon a time, most of the land was covered by the ice. And, you know, and the oldest remains of the human found in Africa is 2 million old. Sorry, more than 1 million years old. So this proves, you know, the origin of humankind is Africa. So that's, you know, the first point, you know, you tell them, you know, that the origin of the life and Azon is come from Africa. Now, then about invention, you know. For the start, the origin of the invention, you know, was for the military purpose. Now, not for, you know, for the useful purpose. You know, that's true, you know, it was invented in Europe, you know, by the white man. But also, you know, if you check in the history of the black man, you see, they have invented a lot of useful tools. For example, you know, refining sugar. It is, you know, invented by you know, an inventor. It happens to be black. And then, you compare about, you know, who loves the art more, the white man or the black man? Now, when you shake, you know, it's the black man is more, has the inclined towards the art, towards the music. For example, you know, also in Africa, they found, you know, pictures on the camp, more than a thousand, nearly, you know, say, 50,000 years old. So, you know, you bring all those things, you know, you copy all those things to them. And they know where they get the civilization, you know. They got it from Spain, because Spain, 500 years ruled by the Islam. And those Muslims ruled Spain, who they were all black people from Africa. So it's not so, as well again, now their civilization, white man's civilization is, you know, is the civilization of the black man. And there are a lot of things, for example, reminding about that the black athletic in 1930 in Olympic, you know, game, in front of the Hitler, you know, he ran and he built, you know, the white athletic. And then tell them about Muhammad Ali. So you make such comparison, you know, because they have very simple mind, you know. If you make such comparison, you know, they cannot do anything.
Same.
I was interested in this question of sexism. There seems to be a move, I don't know how strong it is, and I don't know whether the speaker has noticed it or not, among certain scientists to sort of falsely compensate women for having been oppressed, as it were, in society. Certain scientists, you know, they feel a bit guilty about it, come up with all sorts of strange theories about the sort of superiority of women. Now, it is a fact that certain biological features, they are, you know, more durable, as it were, than men. I mean, women tend to live longer than men, for example. So, I mean, that simple sort of level, you could argue that you know, with some slight, it is very slight sort of biological basis. However, I had a program on BBC Two television once with the rather very over-dramatic title, The Fight to Be Male. And it went and it started off, the first example they gave was an island somewhere in the South Pacific, I think it is. But anyway, they weren't telling you what the name of the island, because the people on it, for reasons which will become clear quite shortly, didn't want too much publicity. I should say that the island was Spanish-speaking. I don't know if that gives us many clues as to where it was. But apparently, some of the children on this island went through an extremely strange process. Children who had apparently been born female changed sex just around about the time of puberty. Children who had been born without penises grew them. Now, this is a perfectly natural thing. What had happened, in fact, what had actually happened was that the islanders were largely descended from obviously there must be other people involved there, but largely descended from one sailor who had gone there in the 1850s, and he'd through some strange hereditary condition that he had, passed on this, you know, there was some some process not taking place in the development of the embryo, so delayed until later on. This is actual fact. Now, this program went further and suggested, in fact, that the natural form of the human body, it said, was female. And it made that suggestion on very crude grounds, because if anybody who know anything about the development of an embryo know that you know, up till, you know, when it becomes recognisably sort of shaped like a human being, both sexes look much the same on the surface. There's, you know, there's an opening, sort of vaginal opening to them in both sexes. But of course, this neglects the fact that the programming is already there in any case. You know, it's not a matter of chance that some human beings actually are born male and the rest are born female. It's been predetermined in any case. So what you were getting, in fact, was a sort of very strange sort of attempt to, as it were, falsely compensate women, as I say, for this oppression that they've suffered, based on a sort of swing of the pendulum, as it were, on the one hand, and on the other, based on nothing more or less than the old-fashioned view about the sort of mystical attributes of women. It was in fact drawing on a very old-fashioned, very sexist view to try and sort of reverse the sexist process. And as I mentioned, the Tolbrians, I think, just as a sort of by the way, as an incidental, it is in fact the case that so culturally determined or culturally associated, shall we say, culturally conditioned, can our attitudes to sexual matters be? The Tolbrians didn't even know, for example, that there was any connection between sex and reproduction. They didn't associate the two at all. As far as they were concerned, human beings came into the world. They all sort of, the spirits came from some island or other out in the ocean and entered through the woman's head and came out the other end, as it were. And sex was simply something that you did for fun. Now, even when it was explained to them, I mean, Conrad Slapper has pointed to the hilarity that ensued the first time that a kiss was demonstrated to them. Even when the actual scientific processes were explained in fairly simple terms, they did not believe it. They just simply refused to believe it. So, I mean, this is, I think, a very interesting example of how culturally associated matches the sex. Does Conrad Slapper have anything to say about
it? No, not much.
What's this say,
though? You see, when I said that the Tolbrians had great hilarity at this demonstration that was performed for them, I didn't say who was demonstrating it. This may be a factor that's relevant, we don't know. And the words, as for this rather fantastical imagery that you've depicted on a number of areas, in the words of the chairman to me, he says it's a cock and bull story. It's too shy to say it, so. But no, as it happens, there's a lot of scientific evidence. I mean, the idea of hermaphrodites, which is what you started off by describing, people who are in fact physically of both sexes or are one and then become the other. This is not just the source of sort of school child's gossip or what have you. It does exist as a biological phenomenon in a few cases.
There have been 300.
Well, you've gone around and counted them, I'll say.
There have been 300 medically recorded cases of true hermaphroditism.
300. Oh, right. I haven't got much to say because you lost me a tiny bit. I'm in the sense that I'm not quite sure about a lot of things you say, but there are just two quick points that might be of interest. Firstly, I'd say that the basis for ignoring physical differences between men and women is the increasing domination of the social over the biological evolution in the present millennium. So that, in other words, not only are the physical differences between men and women genital, in that sense, obviously sexual, but there are other differences which are well established scientifically. In other words, it's clearly, fairly clearly the case that the average height of men is greater than the average height of women. It's a fact. And similarly I was going to say weight there, I wouldn't be 100% sure. Certainly I've read that it is, but maybe we're a bit dubious even there. But there are basically physical characteristics of men other than the obviously sexual ones, in broad terms, of being bigger or taller or heavier. And so in that sense, there are these major physical differences. Now, you might say, well, these are highly significant. These are going to allow men to rationalise and justify a position of dominance and superiority. The answer is no. They might once have done, in a far more primitive stage, in which biological characteristics were more uppermost in determining behaviour because of the division of labour. When the division of labour in a primitive situation was between, let's say, when you were in a hunter-gatherer stage, and it was women who largely formed the role of gathering, in the form of roots and so on, and men were doing the hunting, largely because of their superior physical prowess for that task. But because you're in a primitive stage of development there, that division of labour is very, very rigid and enforced. It's not planned out in a sophisticated and cooperative way. It's a sort of brutish division of labour that's forced on them by dire necessity. What I'm saying is that in the current millennium, broadly speaking, in the current long-term epoch, with what's loosely referred to as modern civilization, in other words, since the Neolithic Revolution, what's happening is that increasingly social evolution has come to become far more important than biological evolution. And it's the new form of evolution, in a sense. And for that reason, we can say no, to hell with it. We don't care if men happen to be a bit bigger than women. It doesn't have to be relevant anymore, because with modern tools, women can use these tools, and the difference in that sense becomes less important. So I say, from that point of view, there's every reason for ignoring increasingly any differences whatsoever between the physicality of men and women. The only other point I'd make is a quotation from the book I referred to, which really is an excellent book on a lot of these issues, Male and Female by Margaret Mead. And this is on the first point that you made about perhaps people trying to make allowances and sort of going out of their way to portray women as being as deserving a superior role or what have you. She says, every hesitancy in a woman and every bit of bluster in a man are not to be laid to some male conspiracy to keep women in their place, any more than every bit of blundering shyness in a man or of conceited demandingness in a woman is to be laid to some female conspiracy to dominate men. Different cultures have styled the relationships between men and women differently. That's a good point. And the second other point I quote from her, there's a lot more good stuff in this book, this is just another example. She says, the suffering of either sex, of the male who is unable because of the way in which he was reared to take the strong initiating or patriarchal role that is still demanded of him, or of the female who has been given too much freedom of movement as a child to stay placidly within the house as an adult. This suffering, this discrepancy, this sense of failure in an enjoined role is the point of leverage for social change. Which is very clearly there outlining basically why I was arguing earlier that these are socialised roles right the way along the line. And even the examples you gave are themselves examples of socialisation to a large extent in the determining sexuality of the groups you describe. So from that point of view, she's really endorsing what we were saying earlier. And that's partly right, the reason why Margaret Mead over the past few years has come under a veritable tirade of abuse from all kinds of other people in that field, most of whom have tried to knock down some of the very arguments put in this book, but I haven't got immediate access to their stuff, so I'll just mention the past, and people who are interested may want to follow up the anti-Meadists and see what they've got to say.
Is there anyone else?
I wonder if Snapper knows about the Enoch Powell, on 1960 when he was Minister of Health. He himself been involved in recruiting nurses from Jamaica.
It's 9:30, yeah. What I'd say is just to remind members and non-members that we've still got it's the penultimate meeting next week, as I mentioned earlier. What about religion? And let's see you there. Just to also thank you for reflection of 1449, and to remind you, and if you haven't got a current socialist standing, there are table at the back there, or any other literature, and I think there are even some more free leaflets that you might not know of on the table. Thanks very much for attending.